Hey guys, what's up? This is Yannick Miller from the Science Debating and Creationism podcast, once more with an episode which follows after a quite long break from episode 4. I think it's been like 2 years or even more than that. But what happened is I had an interview with Zachary Moore, the maker of the Evolution 101 podcast, and I recorded like 20 minutes of interview. And I was really excited about it, and then my laptop crashed, and I lost all data on it because it wouldn't start up anymore, and I've spent some nerdy nights trying to recover it, but I couldn't do it, so I was really demotivated by that, and decided to lay the podcast on ice for a while, or for all time. And like last week, a friend asked me about the laptop, and I said, well, I don't use it anymore, and he was like, oh, can I use it? And I was like, no, it doesn't work. And he dared me to show him that it doesn't work, and so I turned it on, and see, it worked. Well, I have a new laptop in the meantime, but I managed to recover all the data that I had on it, and just wanted to bring you that brief interview with Zachary Moore. You will have to wait for the random facts and for the logical fallacy sections until next episode. I've decided to do these episodes in a slower pace, like once a month, so that I have enough time besides everything else I'm doing. I have to say that it's great to be back, and I hope you're doing well, and I hope you've achieved something during the last 2 years. So here's that interview, and I wish you the best. Zachary Moore, it's very nice to have you here with us today.
Well, thanks, Yannick. It's my pleasure, of course.
So you were here to tell us about molecular evidence for evolution. Now, can you tell us what molecular evidence actually is?
Right. Well, when we talk about molecular evidence, we're talking about specific molecules, particularly DNA and proteins. And we can actually, given that we're now in the genomic age in which new organisms are sequenced. Their genomes are sequenced seemingly every month. In fact, just the other week in Science, they released a new sea anemone genome. So now we're in the kind of unique position, of actually being able to lay out the sequences of these molecules. And both DNA and protein are polymers. That is, they're made up of individual subunits. Each one is somewhat unique. With DNA, there's four different subunits, the different nucleotides, and with the proteins, there's about 20 amino acids. Excuse me, I got something in my throat that we have, and so we can actually sequence both of these molecules. And the main premise that sort of comes into play here is that we know. Okay. The one thing that we can verify empirically, experimentally, in the laboratory, wherever, that we know virtually with 100% certainty is that organisms which share sequences do so because of direct lineage relationships. That is to say that if, like, for example, your genome, you get your genome, the particular sequence that you have, you get from your father and from your mother. And you can work backwards so that your father gets his sequences from his father and his mother, and so on and so forth. So we know that as this process goes on, as this lineage follows, that these sequences are copied and they're passed along to the next line in the next generation down the line. So the inference that allows us to make is that if we find two organisms with very, very similar sequences in their genome or in their proteome or whatever, that allows us to infer some sort of genealogical or ancestral relationship, much in the same way that if you had a long-lost cousin that perhaps you didn't know about, but you just happened to run into somebody who looked a lot like you, and you sequenced your DNA and found that your DNA was very, very similar to theirs, you could then infer that this is probably a long-lost cousin. And so we were able to do the basically the same thing with molecular sequences from DNA and protein and apply that to a larger scale and actually compare them among different completely different species. And in that way, we can infer phylogenetic relationships and postulate ancestral species that had existed. And what this actually shows us is pretty much what we've seen with the fossil evidence. There's been very little to contradict what we've actually seen with the fossil evidence. And in fact, an argument could be made that we could recapitulate the entire theory of evolution based solely on the molecular evidence if, for some hypothetical reason, no fossils had ever been discovered.
So you say only with DNA evidence we could basically hold up the whole theory still.
Oh, absolutely. And it's even stronger than the fossil evidence because there's always, whenever you're comparing fossils, you're sort of operating on the best guess. Whatever the appearance of the whatever the structure is, or the hip, or the fingers, or whatever, you're going by whatever it looks most closely like. And most of the time, that is going to follow phylogenetically. But there are some weird cases where we've actually it hasn't been, I guess, a complete reversal. But for example, the cetacean family, whales and dolphins, etc., they were sort of placed in their own family for a long time. And I mean, it was recognized that whales and dolphins and those sorts of creatures were all related to each other, but it wasn't quite sure where they fit in with all the other mammals. And what we've been able to verify, and this was suspected by for a long time with some fossil evidence, but the molecular evidence has shown this without much doubt, that whales, etc., are all descended from a quadruped, sort of an ungulate. Similar to a hippopotamus. In fact, the hippopotamus is actually what they're most closely related to among all other mammals. So it seems that they're actually derived from that family, believe it or not.
That's great. So, could you give us like a single example of this molecular evidence? How does this specific thing look? I chose the form of endogenous retroviruses here. How does
Right,
that look?
so there's quite a number of these evidences, and you can find them. Any of the listeners can find them by going to talkorigins.org and going to the molecular evidence for evolution page as part of the 29 plus evidences for macroevolution that have been compiled by Dr. Doug Theobald. And so he talks about all of those, and I'll just list them. I won't get into them, but there is DNA. Sequence redundancy. There is a protein functional redundancy, and those are both in the coding sections of the genome, the things that actually give rise to genes and proteins that carry out important functions in every living organism. And then once you look into the non-coding region of the genome, this is the area that is sometimes referred to as junk DNA. It's not completely junk, but it is technically non-coding, and you find in there transposons, which, if you compare those among different organisms, you can determine phylogenetic relationships. There's also pseudogenes, shared pseudogenes. These are non-functional genes. They do not code for any gene product, and yet we find these similar sequences among organisms that are related. And finally, we have endogenous retroviruses, and a virus. As you know, a virus is something that causes you to be sick, but basically it's a tiny little bag of protein and genetic information, either DNA or RNA. It's not technically alive under the way that we define life right now, But it does do a lot of things that are similar to things that are alive. So it's kind of this continuum of living organisms. So it's not quite alive, and it's not quite not alive either. But most viruses, the ones you're most familiar with, are tiny little particles that infect a cell and insert their DNA, and their DNA creates more virus particles, and this creates a load, a burden for most healthy cells and causes them to perform under function and become sick and even die. And that's what causes most viral diseases. Now, a retrovirus is something different from a regular virus in that instead of just inserting its DNA, its genetic information, into the cell, it actually patches its DNA or RNA into the host genome. So it actually inserts its genetic information into the host's genome. And this is a permanent thing. Anytime you are infected with a retrovirus, it because it inserts itself into your genome, it's not something that can be just sort of wiped clean. And this is why, for example, the human immunodeficiency virus, HIV, it can never technically be cured because it's a retrovirus. And so once somebody is infected with it, they're going to have that viral information in their cells permanently. Now, what can happen sometimes, usually the cells that are infected are cells that die off when the person dies off. But sometimes, if an infection happens in a cell that gets passed on, for example, a cell that will eventually become a sperm cell, well, that cell will then become another organism. The child or the offspring of the person who was originally infected or the organism that was originally infected. And that offspring is then born with their entire genome, carries a copy of this virus. And of course, the virus genome is not necessary for them to function. And so it is susceptible to the same random mutation processes that all of the rest of the non-coding regions are. And so what tends to happen is that these retroviruses, if they become endogenous, that is, if they're passed on to offspring, tend to accumulate mutations and then become non-functional. But the sequence is still basically there. And so we can identify, let's say that your grandfather was infected with a retrovirus that he passed on to your father and all of your father's siblings. Well, then you could identify, that would be a tag. Sort of a marker that you could identify everyone who came down through that lineage, all of your paternal relatives, because they will all have, or they're all very likely to have, a copy of this retrovirus. And so, again, just like what I mentioned before, we can do the same thing. We can expand this out and compare different organisms and see if there is any endogenous retroviruses that they have in common. And in fact, there are. We're able to find quite a lot of these in humans. There's about 1% or every 1 out of 100 parts of the genome is actually composed of endogenous retrovirus sequences. About 30,000, I think. And there was a really interesting paper published in 2000 by a Russian group, Lebedev et al., who looked at one particular retrovirus, human endogenous retrovirus K or HERVK, and they looked at insertions of this virus in in the genomes, basically, of different primate species. So humans, chimpanzees, gorillas, orangutans, old world monkeys, and new world monkeys. And what they found is that the further out you go, if you assume humans to be a starting point, the further away you go from humans, the less endogenous retroviruses we have in common with other primates. So, for example, we have the most common endogenous retroviruses of this particular sequence. We have the most in common with chimps, with chimpanzees. And then the next most similar primate to us in terms of similar endogenous retrovirus insertions are gorillas. And down the line, orangutans are the next most common, and then the old world monkeys are the next most common, and then the new world monkeys. And you can actually lay this out, and they actually have a figure in their paper that shows the organization of all these species in a cladogram the phylogenetic relationships of all these organisms laid out according to how many retrovirus insertions they have in common with each other. And it's uncanny because it replicates exactly what we would predict from, you know, fossil evidence and looking at homology and, you know, all the other evidence that's led up to the modern evolutionary theory. Everything that we have seen from all these other different, vastly different types of evidence that tell us that this is the phylogenetic relationship among primates. All we have to do is look at the retroviruses, and that shows us the exact same thing highly consistently. So it's very powerful. Like I said before, you could basically replicate the entire theory of, I say that it's a little aggrandizing, but you could pretty much write the whole thing. If Darwin didn't have any of his finches to look at or anything else from the Galapagos, if there was no study of geology, no study of fossils, paleontology, anything like that, you could still look at the genomes and come to the exact same conclusion. So it's very powerful evidence, and again, it leads us right back into evolutionary theory.
And as you said, endogenous retroviruses are only one part of many of the DNA evidence for evolution.
Right. Yeah. There's actually the transposons are actually a much. I said that the transposons are or the retroviruses are about 1% of our genome. Or the transposons are even more than that. I think. How much do we have from transposons? I want to say it's even more than that, much more than that. And transposons work kind of the same way. In fact, you could kind of think of them as internal retroviruses because they're inserting and removing themselves from within the genome much the same way that retroviruses do. And again, we can compare different transposon insertions among different species and find the same phylogenetic arrangement.
So what most people think about when you talk about DNA evidence, they just think like, oh, humans and chimps have like 98% of their DNA is the same, but there's actually much more to DNA evidence than people think.
Oh yeah, right? That's just the tip of the iceberg, just the tip of the iceberg.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Zachary Moore, for being with us today and explaining us about this great evidence.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks so much, Yannick.
Thank you.